But we can begin. I'm Sarah Naylor, and I work for the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs in Washington, D.C. And the issue that we're going to talk about today, as you know, is women and children in poverty. We're going to do that a couple of times during the time that I'm here. And so today, what I'd like to do is to focus on the attitudes and systems which contribute to the cycle of poverty. So, and then on Monday, what we'll be doing is talking about women and children in poverty, but we're going to be talking about moving from apathy to action and the kind of advocacy that we can be involved in that helps to change that cycle. So it'll be a two-phase kind of thing. And today, to just set the context, what I want to do is to play a tape for you that is really an amateurish tape. That's what I was talking with Lo about, who works here. Because this is a tape that my husband Ed made for me that is excerpts from the movie and Gloria Naylor's book, The Women of Brewster Place. And there are about five different excerpts. You'll notice that it's really fuzzy in between those excerpts. So please know that this is really not a primo operation here. But as this tape is playing, there are some questions I'd like you to consider as you're looking at it. The first question is, how are the people trapped in poverty that you see there? And can there be solutions or hope out of the entrapment that they're engaged, that they're involved in? And then how can we be or continue to be agents for change to make a difference for people who are entrapped in that cycle of poverty? Okay? So, let's turn it on. We'll roll the tape. It'll be about 15 minutes.
Hi. My name is Katana Brown. I live in apartment 312.
Oh, yeah. You moved in the other day. I saw it.
No, no. I actually moved in a few weeks ago. The other day, my boyfriend was moving in. A road for me. Anyway, what I'm trying to do is, I'm trying to get people interested in starting a tenants association. The way it works is, did you know that almost every building on this street is owned by the same man? And if we just... I'm sorry. That little boy is eating out of the garbage.
That's what we call relief, you know, hell yes. You're lucky he ain't doing the worst.
Richard, come and I'll help. Come up.
Rapid case of
special people.
First patient to survive.
Hi. Mama, I ain't done nothing. You tell this damn fool I ain't done nothing. What a way to talk.
Come on.
I ain't done nothing. Richard, I'm sorry. Did he steal something from you? He's always taking things. I whooped him for it, but he won't stop. I tried to tell a dumbass his teachers are threatening to send him to reform school. You hear that, you dumbhead? Reform school.
Wait, it's nothing like that. He was downstairs eating out of the garbage, and I thought you should know because, well, he might be hungry or something.
I know he does that.
The best.
He's looking for sweets. The dentist at the clinic said all his teeth are rotten, so I won't give him anything sweet. So he goes hiding through the garbage, looking for candy. Now, I tried to make him stop, but you can't be everywhere at once. I figured once he gets sick from that filthy habit, he'll stop by his
house.
Believe me, my kids get plenty to eat. I got two full books of food stamps I ain't even used. I was just about to cook dinner when you came to the door. Y'all come on in here, it's almost time to eat. Y'all hear me? I said get in here, you little damn son. Don't worry, I'll take care of these fools.
First.
You overheard it.
You see anybody else in here?
Gene, the baby's
sleeping. Can't a man even relax in his own home without everybody picking on him?
I'm not picking on you. I just don't care about the baby.
What about me? Huh? What, do I matter around here no more?
Well, I'll tell you what the answer to that is. Hell no.
Everybody's more important than me. Your friends, the baby.
There ain't nothing around here no more.
I don't care what she says. The kid doesn't eat garbage unless he's hungry. Besides, Cece Baker and that gang out there in the alley, the kid that age has no business being out there alone. Anything can happen.
Maybe she's got far away, isn't it?
That apartment. Trash everywhere. Dirty dishes piled up all over the same kids running wild. I don't even know how many. And I swear, all she cared about was that I was interrupting her soap opera.
Well, shit's a little bit more complicated than that.
Well, that's great. Her mother's gonna love that.
Just one, you can't expect people who live here under these conditions to think and act like the people you grew up around.
I grew up in an area just like this. I know what it's like.
Oh, sure. I'm not completely naive. I didn't expect this to be Linden Hills. I just thought that these people would be a little bit more... I don't know. I expected them to care.
What makes you think they don't? What you gonna do, write off the woman as a human being because she got dirty dishes in the sink? I've known people like Coralie my whole life.
All I'm saying is, I'm not sure how to help someone like Coralie.
You gotta find a way. And if you can't find a way, you gotta make a way.
People have had their life be nothing for years. You can't change something like that overnight. But you can't run away from a problem because there's no easy answer either. That's what everyone else does. Me, you and I are supposed to be different.
I don't know. I'll get a second job. You can find another job. It'll be okay.
That ain't gonna do it this time, Sil. We ain't got no money coming in. We got another baby on the way. How are we gonna make it?
I don't know. We'll be fine.
No, it ain't gonna be fine. But I'm doing the best I can right now.
I know that, honey.
Sil, I'm just tired of us never getting ahead.
Oh, baby. When I have this baby, I'll get my tubes tied.
So what the hell are we supposed to feed it when it gets here? Air? It's babies and bills. Babies and bills, that's all you're good for. I'm telling you, with two kids and you on my back, Seal, I ain't gonna never have nothing. You hear me? Nothing.
Garbage and ash, yeah. and you don't break the glass in the door.
And how about that riffraff that hang out in the alley?
Yeah.
I'm selling drugs back there by that wall.
Ain't nothing, no good going on back there by that wall. It's just a gathering place for Lola.
That damn wall.
Block all my fun. I can't get a cactus to grow in my apartment.
Okay, you're all going to get a chance to voice your concerns, I promise. The thing is, we've got to do this in a constructive manner, or we're just wasting our time. It's just like that wall you're all so upset about. That wall does what that wall is supposed to do. It closes us in. It holds us back. It shuts us off from the rest of the world.
Uh-huh.
Now, we can get to the other side, but we've got to climb over it, or go around it, or just knock it down.
Oh,
we're never going to get anywhere if we just stand and bang our heads against it.
All right.
Does that make any sense?
Well, I still say Ben's got no business being here.
A lot of folks got no business being here. Well, you got to pick on one on one.
I ain't banging my head against nothing.
Well, if y'all ain't going to do nothing but fight, I'd rather be home watching my TV. I'm missing my soul.
Oh, that paint dryer, CeCe Baker, will be right back here. The can of spray paint, putting up them old nasty words right back up there.
Plenty more paint where this came from. We got to wear them down.
You paint this whole wall every color of the rainbow, still be our soul. Can't stand this ugly old thing. I don't even know why it's got to be here.
Traffic control. I did some research. This neighborhood was originally supposed to be a major business district, but the traffic got too busy and the city decided to block off some of the auxiliary streets. There was this big battle about it at City Hall because nobody wanted their block to become a dead-end street.
Why didn't somebody fight for this street?
I'm sure they did, but the streets with the most political clout won, which meant the rich people's streets stayed open and Brewster Place got the wall. It's a shame. We could have been a main artery of this town.
Ain't that the story? Colored folks try to do a little something, somebody come along and throw up a wall.
Why don't you do something about it?
What I'm supposed to do? I could tear down this wall with my bare hands and just send somebody in the next day to put it up again.
But at least you would have done something.
Standing in the way of good.
fucking hell. Just like that wall. Blocking off this street. And I'm...
Tired! Y'all hear me? I'm tired of it.
And I can't stand it no more.
Superiority.
Lack of space. Just physical. Lip.
What In what ways do you think that some of these things could be alleviated? What are some of the systems in society that need to be evident that you saw lacking there? In addition to these things you're telling me about.
Empowerment.
Solidarity.
Some basic stuff.
Jobs. Like
housing.
Housing.
I mean, this stuff isn't new that we're talking about.
Food.
Food.
Money.
Profit. Since it really needs to connect the person, the people with the services that are available.
So,
an advocate.
Yay! A support group.
How about child care?
Parenting skills?
Mm-hmm. Well, at any rate, we could go on and on and on with that list. It's interesting, I've shown this, what this was for all of you, for those of you who came in while that was in process, is that it's excerpts from the movie, the miniseries, Women of Brewster Place, that was on television, and we just took 5 excerpts from that film, from that movie, to be able to show some of the issues of poverty, but to set it in a context that you can feel and touch rather than me just standing before you and telling you all about it. People, in order to make changes, I believe, do it best when they can feel it. When they can feel what that's like, when they know someone who's gone through it, when they provided assistance in some way, when they themselves have felt the pain. And what I will be doing with you for these next several days is talking about some issues, but you need to know that I come at it from the perspective of advocacy. And so I believe that one doesn't necessarily have to have experienced it, but I do believe that some of the best advocacy takes place when you can put yourself in another person's shoes, or when you yourself have felt it. So that's what this is an attempt to do. And I just want to say to you that the book is in the bookstore. There are about 10 to 15 copies in the bookstore for those of you who would wish to read it if you haven't already. It is an excellent book that tells the stories of basically 7 women and what their dreams were and how they've been shattered, and how the systems that tend to be oftentimes racist and classist, systems of exclusion, have made life very difficult for these women. And so I wanted you all to have an opportunity to have that as an experience. How did you feel when you saw this, personally? What happened for you in this?
Sad.
Why?
I just feel that so many of us are so isolated from those situations. It's just hard to almost connect with it, but it just makes me sad when you think there are so many that are living in those situations.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
I felt I just came in for the last one and a half segments, but when the Oprah Winfrey character made a move to start beating on that wall, I felt tremendous hope, and she was very strong.
Yes.
And that her community was being organized by her leadership, and people were following and coming through, and I felt there was some real movement for change there that seemed optimistic to me.
Yes, hopeful.
You know, when people get that angry and then they get together and work together as friends on something, it's wonderful.
Yeah, and the wall was coming down. The wall, for me, represents just the barriers that are set up by society that get in people's way. And in this society, many times, the barriers are drawn on economic lines and on racial lines. And so this, for me, is just a very, very powerful, powerful movie for all that it represents. Let me just give you some facts, because I think that that's just real important to do, too, as we discuss the issues of women and children in poverty. And then we'll have a chance to really get into a much more in-depth conversation. In the United States today, there are 32.5 million people who go to bed hungry every night. 32.5 million. 32.5. In 1987, an estimated 32.5 million people were living on incomes under the poverty threshold. Today, a family of four earning $12,696 per year represents the 100% poverty level. According to the 1987 census figures, 13 million children under 18 years old were living in poverty, or one in five. According to the Children's Defense Fund, today those figures would look more like every one in four child. Every child, one child in four are living in poverty. Women and children made up 78% of the poverty population in 1987. Let's talk about the groups at risk in poverty. And this, again, is using 1987 census figures. Every 1 in 11 married couple families with children was poor in 1987. But 1 in 2 mother-only families were poor. Can you believe that? The mother-only family, of course, was more at risk. If we use this standard, families with children are more at risk than families without children. Younger families are more at risk than older families. Families of color and language are more at risk than white families. Families headed by a single female are more at risk than any other family. In 1986, of all black, single, female-headed households under the age of 25 with children, 88% were below the poverty threshold. Of all female-headed households living in poverty, 53% were white and 44% were African-American. 16% were Hispanic. And however, the poverty rates were lower for white mother-only families than for African-American families, and all the others, actually. Documents that I've researched said that there were too few Native American families or figures to count during that time, so that the figures that went in to make up this data do not include Native American families. And that says a lot to me about the systems of exclusion. Ed and I lived in Arizona for about I lived there for 9.5 years. He lived there, I guess we were both there 9.5 years. And during that time, we watched how Native American people are made to be invisible in that environment. For about 3.5 years, I directed the Lutheran Office for Governmental Ministry in Arizona, and I watched firsthand how the legislature,
tended to exclude Native American people by playing federal guidelines and regulations against the state guidelines and regulations. And so when people would come into Phoenix at the state to the state capitol to advocate on their behalf, somehow the legislature did not calendar the event that involved them. And they had to turn around and go home the next day, and of course it showed up on the calendar the next day when they weren't there to speak on their own behalf. It's just my own personal experience of watching that and trying to fight for it, and so often I was the only person working as an advocate on behalf of Native American people. So I find it hard to believe, you know, that figures, I understand that figures weren't there, but there's some reasons for that. At any rate, some of the needs for our involvement around issues of women and children in poverty relate to issues of housing, which we've talked about, hunger issues, healthcare concerns, employment opportunities, and the like. And during this time of being here, I want to spend some time with you talking about some of those issues more in depth. According to a recent article in the Washington Post, there has been a dramatic or a significant shift in the social vision in our country. The idea of egalitarianism, or a sharing of the power equally among all people, that idea is dead at this point. It died during the administration of the 80s. For 50 years, ever since Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, both Democrats and Republicans accepted the concept that the government has a responsibility to narrow the gap between the poor, between the rich and the poor. That concept no longer guides the American economic policies. Instead, inequality is now being widely defended as a source of productivity and economic growth. For example, President Bush's proposal to cut the capital gains taxes, which benefits the rich. He has proposed a capital gains tax to benefit the rich. And even Senator Moynihan's proposal to reduce Social Security tax burdens on the working and middle class did not suggest taxing the rich at a higher rate. Because of this shift in consciousness, the church now more than ever before really has a need to speak. You know, we need to be there to speak on behalf of people who are poor and powerless and disenfranchised. And we need to really infuse the systems with a different kind of understanding. The work that I and others do in Washington is about that, trying to help that happen. But I need to say to you that my bias is that I, as an advocate in Washington, don't do that alone. You know, I work for you. I work with you. And it is my task to try to help you all understand the need to be involved in the systems of government that can help to make a difference. So not only at the federal level, but at the state level, at the county level, and wherever you see systems of inequality operating, it's important for you to be involved to try to make a difference. We'll talk more about that later. Are there any thoughts or questions or concerns about what I've said so far? Well, let me share with you, I have shown this tape that you saw this evening about five times now. And it's been really interesting to me. I've shown it to different audiences. Twice when I showed it, it was to a group of African American women who were attending the Women of the ELCA pre-gathering conference for persons of color and language. That response was, I could feel the pain, you know, in the room. And I've also decided this is a risky tape to show because of all that it evokes. The next two audiences that saw it were also people at the Women of the ELCA, women who were attending the Women of the ELCA convention. And it was a mixed audience. And in that group, the wonderful thing that happened is that people felt that they could say what they were really feeling. And so one woman said, can't we do something about birth control for people? You know, that was one response. Another was, you know, the woman with the children, she really needed respite. She really needed somebody to come and give her a break. And so there was that kind of sensitivity to her issues. There were persons there who didn't understand the systems, and so I shared a little bit about my history, which I think I'll do that now. I grew up in a place called Del Paso Heights, outside of Sacramento, California. And it was a very poor neighborhood. I lived there until I was 18 when my parents moved into town. And my first experience of systems of exclusion, my first experience that I can recollect that was a system of exclusion, was when in junior high school, the boundaries for my junior high were gerrymandered. They drew new lines and moved the children who were from more affluent families to a junior high that was closer to town. And that left a large proportion of children attending that junior high school who were from very low economic families. There was not one adult person who had gone to college or had graduated from a college in my neighborhood. When I got to high school, I signed up for college prep classes, and the counselor said to me, why are you doing that, Sarah? You're only going to clean someone's house. So, you know, my parents came to school. I was lucky. I had parents who said, no way. And they came to school to try to make a difference in that particular instance. And I was lucky because I had parents who had different vision for their kids. But, you know, the people that I played with were kids who, one in junior high school, one of my friends had been prostituting. And I didn't know it until I walked home with her one day. And here was a man there who said, come in here, Joanne. And I looked. And somehow, at that time, I can remember putting it together and running home as quickly as I could get there because I was scared to death. And, you know, the drugs and the violence, people getting shot every weekend at the bar down the street. So at any rate, when I was in high school, another time, the school, what do you call it? The school slipped my mind.
Administration. Counseling.
Made the same kind of decision, and they decided to build a high school in North Sacramento, closer into town. They moved kids out again. They not only moved kids out, they moved teachers out. I was in the orchestra. You know, there were four or five of us little black kids in the orchestra, me walking through this neighborhood carrying my violin to school. But at any rate, you know, we had an orchestra, and the best teacher in the district was removed and taken to this other school. And that's when I became angry. and began to understand, but also felt hopeless to do anything, you know, what do you do with that? So, at that point, I guess I began to really understand, and at that point, there has never been a question in my mind, but that I would really work to advocate on behalf of the issues that people really encounter and struggle with. And advocacy takes place in all kinds of forms. But we'll get into that another time. What? Yeah.
Can you back up a minute and explain more? You made some statements about the current administration having a set of priorities that involve taxing
the poor.
Can you say any more about that? Have they raised taxes for the poor? Have they cut taxes for the rich? Have they left them all the same? How is it working out that the rich are doing so well and the poor are doing so badly?
Well, let me preface it by saying, is that what?
Is that policy?
Proposed policy. Mm-hmm. Let me just say before I answer that I've been an advocate for the church now for 6.5 years, and during that time, I've worked with people to help them understand that these issues are not about partisan politics. This is a disclaimer. The issues are not about partisan politics. We are not dealing with what's being introduced by Republicans and what's being introduced by Democrats. What we're talking about are the issues that impact people. And so every time I look at the issues, I am driven by, or my attitudes and my responses are driven in part by those issues that impact people. However, we function in an environment that is very political. And the political environment is Democratic and Republican. And as we develop strategies, we develop them based on what the votes are and counting the votes. But the end goal is to make a difference on behalf of people. Okay? So, now having said that, and there's some other issues too. What time is it getting to? Because I really want to give you something else. The policies, my experiences, part of my portfolio relates to the institutional issues that impact the nonprofit sector, meaning nonprofit organizations and institutions. I had an opportunity to hear a presentation by Dr. Lester Solomon from Johns Hopkins University, who talked about the shift of the way we are moving from a country that provides block grant funding to deal with issues of poverty to giving the people the money, because the argument is that the people who are living in poverty can make the best decisions. We're moving from a government that passes regulations and legislation at the federal level relating to domestic policy to a government that enables state government to maybe make a difference, you know, so that we're moving from a more centralized system to a decentralized system. We've been doing that for a while now. The experience is that when that happens, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. The experience is that it allows a President Bush to really offer proposals, legislative proposals, that tend to enable the rich to get richer. And that's happening. That proposal is happening through capital gains taxes. It's happening as we look at his proposal and Moynihan's proposal. It's all the same. It's just really happening across the board. And it's really frightening to me. We'll talk about that a little bit more at another time, but it's scary stuff. I want to share with you in one of the sessions this same fact as we look at the issue of Medicaid expansion. I'm going to be doing a session on that. Because what has happened in that case is, fortunately, the federal government has passed regulations to expand Medicaid for women and children and infants. As long as the federal government hadn't passed that particular regulation, the states had options. So that meant that a state like Alabama, for instance, would only pay Medicaid benefits for women at the 14% level instead of the 133% of poverty level that they had the option to do. The disparity is incredible when you start talking about centralized government versus decentralized government. And my bias, when you have that, is you have people at the lower end of the economic scale crying for federal regulations, and the persons who are at the upper end saying, let's decentralize the system. Okay? Anybody else? Well, let me tell you where are we going? 7:10? Does anybody know? We have 10 more minutes? Okay.
Until 7:15.
Let's see. I don't know a nice way to do this. Well, I want to tell you all also that in the Lutheran Church, the work of advocacy has also been guided by social statements. And most denominations and faith groups develop social statements or social policies that guides the work of advocacy, so that that work is put in a context that really reflects our commitment as people of faith. And I'd like to just give you one of them that's taken from the LCA, a predecessor church body of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, relating to the issue of poverty. What we attempt to do in the church is to look at the issues in concrete terms or in the context of society while also looking at the issues that guide us by our faith. So we look at the issues through the lens of the gospel. And so for me, every time I'm talking with people, it's real important for me to reflect that commitment of faith. And that really makes the work that we do as we advocate on behalf of other people, because that's what advocacy is about. Advocacy is pleading the cause or the case of another person, which is a lot different than lobbying. Lobbying means that you are lobbying generally for your own self-interest. As the church, we are lobbying, technically, but we are advocates on behalf of people who are poor and powerless and disenfranchised. And so when I go to Washington, when I was in Arizona, when I went to the state legislature, that kind of interaction made the difference. The basis upon which I represented my work made the difference. Because it was not about personal gain or organizational gain. So, I think I should really, I've talked more than I meant to talk. Do you all have questions or anything that you want to contribute? Yes.
I'm curious about what kind of guidelines or how did, when you're working in advocacy, how do you walk the fine line of keeping it from turning into paternalism, to speaking on behalf of or for people as if they don't have their own voices?
Thank you so much for asking that question. For me, the thing that is always important is making sure that I'm working with people. That it isn't that I'm just going and speaking for them, totally. Every opportunity I get, I'm talking with people and I'm empowering them or attempting to empower them and to bring them into the process. One of the things that I'm excited about that has just happened in our office is that Marian Nicholson, who works with me, and she works on women's issues. She works for the Commission for Women, and she also has been working on farm policy. As a part of the farm bill, which is a mega bill, there is one part of that bill that deals with minority. I can't remember the specific name of the piece, but minority farmers' rights or something like that, dealing with ensuring that primarily black farmers in the South are able to stay on their land. She was able to write a grant to Lutheran Brotherhood, who granted a $5,000 grant to bring black farmers up from Mississippi and Georgia to speak on their own behalf at the Capitol and before members of Congress. And the exciting thing about it is that the Senate voted unanimously to include this portion in the bill. And we were there. That's exciting. And now we have to deal with the House. You know, that's the House of Representatives, and that's another issue. But wherever possible, it's important to bring people into the process. Yes?
I work in home care with a lot of poor families, and I find the ones that are very, very poor, there are programs to help them, but the ones that are just on the border are the ones that they're making too much to qualify for the programs, and yet they can't meet their needs on their own, and those I find are almost as frustrating or more frustrating than the very poor.
Absolutely.
Because I can do something to help the very poor.
Absolutely. I hear you. That's the system at this point. One of the things that I'm working on personally in Washington is I'm working with a number of advocates from different denominations to deal with the issue of universal access to health care that would provide care for people across the board. All those persons, 37 million people who have no access to health care, would be insured under a universal access plan. So all the people that are falling between the cracks would be cared for. Did you know that the ELCA owns 24% of all nonprofit nursing home beds in this country? And because of that, that gives us some clout when we start talking about the issue you're talking about and many others related to healthcare particularly. I have nothing to tell you at this point other than I understand what you're saying.
I think we've seen in the last 10 years or so an emphasis on the safety net idea is that we're taking care of a few folks, but an awful lot of people have gotten away from having benefits in their own.
Absolutely.
And it's put on the basis of the deserving.
Right.
Which is a flashback to Puritan Christianity. You don't work, you don't eat.
Yeah. We've seen it in the issue of the child care bill. You know, I don't know if you've been tracking that, but it's really scary business because some people want to pass out vouchers to the people who have children to place in child care facilities, daycare facilities, versus having block grants that go to the states to administer the program. They want to pass out vouchers because they say that, of course, parents know what's best for their children. Well, if we're talking about people who are living in poverty, who don't have hope, who don't have access to employment opportunities, who are living in really poor conditions, they may know what's best, but they can't always access it, or sometimes they don't even know what's best.
And too, they lack the feeling that they can actually make a difference sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah.
That hope and sense of empowerment.
And the thing is that there's no perfect system. There's no perfect system. So you go with the best you've got. And I advocate for a system that says that we're going to put some stuff in place to take care of people like we have going right now, except it isn't adequate. It is inadequate. So we need to beef that up. That. Anybody else? Yeah.
Well, with that child care bill, isn't there a stipulation that, like, it can't, the way they have tried to pass it, that it couldn't be in the churches, or if it was, they had to cover up for everything?
That was a church-state issue. I mean, it's been really funny. I mean, it hasn't been funny at all. What am I saying? There was that stipulation that said that if a facility a daycare center was operated by a church, to make sure that children were there for instruction that was relevant to their learning, that was offered on a non-biased basis relating to religion, that those facilities would have to cover up all of the religious symbols in the church. And personally, should I do that? Yeah. Personally, I agree with that. Because I believe that children who come from all different religions, faith groups, no faith group, should be there to be together, you know, and to learn together. And that those people who want to have their children in a Christian environment or a Jewish environment will pay for that. But the people who are receiving the benefit of the ABC bill or the Act for Better Child Care bill, if they have to send their children to these places and not have any options themselves because they have to access what's available to them, I don't think that's necessarily fair. And so I have some concerns about that as a person of faith.
I can see how that would lead to a feeling of exclusion from children who come from a different religious background.
Exactly. Exactly. Anybody else?
Do you have a method of joining groups that have similar desires or advocate viewpoints to have more clout?
In Washington, we belong to, or we work, we try to work cooperatively with all the various faith groups that are represented there. And we have an organization that we work with called National Impact. And Interfaith Action for Economic Justice, and a number of other organizations that I'll share with you the last day that I'm here. For those of you who are leaving early and you want some information, I'll be glad to give that to you if you just talk with me apart from this session. But yes, the method that we use is we try to do it cooperatively as much as possible. When we find ourselves in disagreement, we try to agree to disagree so that we don't cause any hard feeling between us. But, you know, it's a very political environment, and that doesn't always happen. but for the most part, it works very well. Well, thank you all for coming. It's been great. You've been a great group, and I'll look forward to seeing you all at some of my other workshops that I'm doing while I'm here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.